Hello, everyone, and welcome. This is a celebration of Maya Angelou. We've decided to do it. I knew Maya because I published her in England. So I'm going to tell little stories about my life with Maya. And it's going to be in between. I'll just do those stories between these very wonderful poets who are going to read either their own poetry or Maya's poetry. And that's the format of the evening. I should start probably by just giving you a very brief biography. You probably all know quite a lot about her. She was born in 1928 and died last year. She was an American writer, a poet, a dancer, an actress, and a singer. She published 7 autobiographies, 3 books of essays, and several books of poetry. She had dozens of awards and more than 50 honorary degrees. She's best known for her autobiographies, which focus on her childhood and her early adult experiences, and the best known one that made her famous was the first, called I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings, which was a lot about her life growing up in Stamps, Arkansas, with her grandmother and with her mother. And then there's a famous moment in that scene, in that book, which a lot of people often quote, about when she's raped by her mother's lover and tells someone. She's 8 or 10. And she tells someone, and the man is arrested, and before he can get to trial, he's kicked to death by people who know Maya. And she was so horrified by feeling that her voice had killed a man that she was mute for quite a long time. She eventually stopped. She had a child when she was 16, a beloved child called Guy, and it changed her life. She remembers her mother accepting the news without condemnation. She says she was Vivian Baxter, hoping for the best, prepared for the worst, and unsurprised by anything in between. She married a Greek sailor, Tosham, who loved jazz and was good to Guy. It didn't last. She got a job as a singer at the Purple Onion nightclub in San Francisco. And she eventually became a poet and a writer, but only after she'd been a cook, a prostitute, a nightclub dancer, a cast member of the opera Porgy and Bess, where she played Ruby in a triumphant international tour. She coordinator of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, a journalist in Egypt and Ghana during the decolonization of Africa. She was active in the civil rights movement and worked with Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, and I remember her telling me about the evening she spent with her brother after Martin Luther King was killed, just trawling the bars in California and listening to people talk, some very sympathetically, some less so. In 1982, she became the first lifetime Reynolds Professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem in North Carolina. In 1993, she recited her poem On the Pulse of Morning at President Clinton's inauguration. Her autobiographies are really very personal and often very candid. Indeed, they were banned in some libraries in America for their candor. She really became a spokesperson for black people and for women. She said, "There's no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you." So I'm going to start by asking George Wallace to read And Still I Rise.
Still I rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? because I walk like I've got oil wells pumping in my living room, just like moons and like suns, with the certainty of tides, just like hopes springing high still, I'll rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head, lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my haughtiness offend you? Don't you take it awful hard, because I laugh like I've got gold mines digging in my own backyard. You may shoot me with your words. You may cut me with your eyes. You may kill me with your hatefulness, but still, like air, I'll rise. Does my sexiness upset you? Does it come as a surprise that I dance like I've got diamonds at the meeting of my thighs? Out of the huts of history's shame I rise. Up from a past that's rooted in pain, I rise. I'm a black ocean, leaping and wide, welling and swelling. I bear in the tide, leaving behind nights of terror and fear. I rise into a daybreak that's wondrously clear. I rise, bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the dream and the hope of the slave. I rise. I rise, I rise.
Next is Juliet Stevenson, who's going to read Caged Bird.
A free bird leaps on the back of the wind and floats downstream till the current ends and dips his wing in the orange sun rays and dares to claim the sky. But a bird that stalks down his narrow cage can seldom see through his bars of rage. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom. The free bird thinks of another breeze, and the trade winds soft through the sighing trees, and the fat worms waiting on a dawn-bright lawn, and he names the sky his own. But a caged bird stands on the grave of dreams. His shadow shouts on a nightmare scream. His wings are clipped and his feet are tied, so he opens his throat to sing. The caged bird sings with a fearful trill of things unknown but longed for still. And his tune is heard on the distant hill, for the caged bird sings of freedom.
Next, George Surtees is going to read A Plague Journey and A Mother in Blackness.
The first is a poem of gloom and the second of return to safe haven. A Plague Journey. There is no warning rattle at the door, nor heavy feet to stomp the foyer boards. Safe in a dark prison, I know that light slides over the fingered work of a toothless woman in Pakistan. Happy prints of an invisible time are illumined. My mouth agape rejects the solid air and lungs hold. The invader takes direction and seeps through the plaster walls. It is at my chamber, entering the keyhole, pushing through the padding of the door. I cannot scream. A bone of fear clogs my throat. It is upon me. It is sunrise with hope, its arrogant rider.
My mind, formerly quiescent in its smug encasement, is strained to look upon their rapturous visages, to let them enter even into me. I am forced outside myself to mount the light and rise joined with hope. Through all the bright hours, I cling to expectation until darkness comes to reclaim me as its own. Hope fades, day is gone into its irredeemable place, and I am thrown back into the familiar bonds of disconsolation. Gloom crawls around, lapping lasciviously between my toes at my ankles, and it sucks the strands of my hair. It forgives my heady fling with hope. I am joined again into its greedy arms. And this is the mothering blank blackness. She came home running back to the mothering blackness, deep in a smothering blackness, white tears, icicle gold planes of her face. She came home running. She came down, creeping here to the black arms waiting, now to the warm heart waiting. Rime of alien dreams befrosts her rich brown face. She came down, creeping. She came home, blameless, black yet as Hagar's daughter, tall as was Sheba's daughter. Threats of northern winds die in the desert's face. She came home, blameless.
Maya was larger than life in every possible way. She was about 6 foot three. She had an extremely raucous laugh. She was huge. The history of her publication in England is actually rather strange. There were three people running Virago Press. We started the press in 1975. She had been a bestseller in America for something like 13 years. And every year, her great friend Jessica Mitford would come to London and try and persuade her publishing friends and her agent friends that they should buy her book, and nobody ever did. And I heard about it by reading a feminist magazine. We feminists did find books earlier than other people. We found Alice Munro earlier. We did occasionally get there first. Anyway, I thought it sounded really interesting. I found it, I read it, and I went to America, and I went to see her agent, Bob Loomis, her publisher, Bob Loomis, at Random House, who had always been her publisher. And I paid £1,000, and I bought the book. And we started planning it, and planning how many we'd print and how we'd publicise it, and she came over. I'd never met her before. I was overwhelmed. I took her for a posh lunch. She looked at me straight in the eye and said, "Ursula, you've bought my book and I will never leave you." Wow. And she never did. She stayed with Virago forever. And she also, what I really loved about her is I got some steak stuck in my throat in that lunch. And I panicked because I thought I was going to choke. And I rushed out to the loo to try and do something. I was so embarrassed. And she came pounding after me and banging on the door and saying, "You mustn't stay in there on your own. You'll die, you'll die." So I loved her for that. Anyway, We published 6,000, we printed 6,000 copies, and we put her on a couple of television shows, small afternoon shows, and got her in a couple of radio, but quite small scale because nobody had heard of her. This was 1984, I think. And within 2 weeks, the 6,000 copies had gone. So we printed another 6,000, and within another 2 weeks, they'd gone too, and we suddenly got it. And we printed 50,000 copies. And she just became the most extraordinary bestseller. But it was an extraordinary thing about Britain that they obviously thought a black girl growing up in Arkansas would be of no interest. To very strange story. Okay, I'm going to ask the next poet to read, who is Maddie Paxman, and she's going to read On Aging.
Yes, I remember going to Camden Town Hall to see Maya in the 80s. That must have been organised by Virago. Packed, absolutely packed with people. So, yes, a poem called On Aging, which she seems to have written when she wasn't that old, really. But pretty much anyone who's past 50 is going to identify with some of it. When you see me sitting quietly like a sack left on the shelf, don't think I need your chattering. I'm listening to myself. Hold, stop, don't pity me. Hold, stop your sympathy. Understanding, if you got it. Otherwise, I'll do without it. When my bones are stiff and aching and my feet won't climb the stair, I will only ask one favour. Don't bring me no rocking chair. When you see me walking, stumbling, don't study and get it wrong, because tired don't mean lazy. And every goodbye ain't gone. I'm the same person I was back then, a little less hair, a little less chin, a lot less lungs and much less wind. But ain't I lucky I can still breathe in?
Now, Sarah Jane Arbery, who's going to read Call Letters, Mrs. VB, and On Reaching 40.
Call Letters, Mrs. VB. Ships? Sure, I'll sail them. Show me the boat. If it'll float, I'll sail it. Men? Yes. I'll love them. If they've got the style to make me smile, I'll love them. Life? Course I'll live it. Let me have breath just to my death, and I'll live it. Failure? I'm not ashamed to tell it. I never learned to spell it. Not failure. On Reaching 40. Other acquainted years sidle with modest decorum across the scrim of toughened tears and to a stage planked with laughter boards and waxed with rueful loss. But 40, with the authorised brazenness of a uniformed cop, stomps no knocking into the script, bumps a funky grind on the shabby curtain of youth and delays the action. Unless you have the inborn wisdom and grace and are clever enough to die at 39.
And now Larry Beckett is going to read his own poem. Ma Rainey.
Back from the late turpentine camp, juke joint, down home, the mother. Ma Rainey lays down her ostrich plume, necklace of coins. She blues, rider, her audience, the tethered rein. And her soul.
See what you have done.
Maya took some persuading to start writing. She'd been doing all these other things, and she was by then a singer and a dancer and a bit of a star. And James Baldwin tried to suggest to Bob Loomis, her editor, that she should write. And the first time he approached her, she said, no, I wouldn't dream of writing. And then he rather cleverly wrote to her and said, I guess autobiography is too difficult a thing to do, at which she immediately said, I'm going to do it. And so she started. She usually wrote on yellow-lined legal pads, and this is her account of how she writes. I've kept a hotel room in every town I've ever lived in. I rent a hotel room for a few months, leave my home at 6, and try to be at work at 6:30. To write, I lie across the bed so that this elbow is absolutely encrusted at the end, just so rough with calluses. I never allow the hotel people to change the bed because I never sleep there. I stay until 12:30 or 1:30 in the afternoon, and then I go home and try and breathe. I look at the work around 5. I have an orderly dinner, proper, quiet, lovely dinner, and then I go back to work the next morning. Sometimes in hotels, I'll go into the room and there'll be a note on the floor which says, Dear Miss Angelou, let us change the sheets. We think they're mouldy. But I only allow them to come in and empty waste baskets. I insist that all things are taken off the walls. I don't want anything in there. I go into the room and I feel as if all my beliefs are suspended. Nothing holds me to anything. No milkmaids, no flowers, nothing. I just want to feel. And then when I start to work, I'll remember, I'll read something, maybe the Psalms, maybe again something from Mr. Dunbar, James Weldon Johnson. And I'll remember how beautiful, how pliable the language is, how it will lend itself. If you pull it, it says, okay. I remember that, and I start to write. So that was her writing pattern. And I'm now going to ask the next poet, who is Jill Abraham, who's going to read Phenomenal Woman and Impeccable Conception.
Thank you. This is one of the first, if not the first, poetry book I ever bought as an adult. This is the 1988 edition of And Still I Rise. And the first poem that I've chosen to read just felt appropriate for present company. Impeccable Conception. I met a lady poet who took for inspiration coloured birds and whispered words, a lover's hesitation. A falling leaf could stir her. A wilting, dying rose would make her write both day and night the most rewarding prose. She'd find a hidden meaning in every pair of pants, then hurry home to be alone and write about romance. As a woman who is not cute or built like a fashion model, this is the attitude that I aspire to. Phenomenal woman. Pretty women wonder where my secret lies. I'm not cute or built to suit a fashion model's size. But when I start to tell them, they think I'm telling lies. I say, it's in the reach of my arms, the span of my hips, the stride of my step, the curl of my lips. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman, that's me. I walk into a room, just as cool as you please, and to a man, the fellows stand, or fall down on their knees. Then they swarm around me, a hive of honeybees. I say, it's the fire in my eyes, and the flash of my teeth, the swing in my waist, and the joy in my feet. I'm a woman, phenomenally phenomenal woman. That's me. Men themselves have wondered what they see in me. They try so much, but they can't touch my inner mystery. When I try to show them, they say they still can't see. I say, it's in the arch of my back, the sun of my smile, the ride of my breasts, the grace of my style. I'm a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman, that's me. Now you understand just why my head's not bowed. I don't shout or jump about or have to talk real loud. When you see me passing, it ought to make you proud. I say, it's in the click of my heels, the bend of my hair, the palm of my hand, the need for my care, 'cause I'm a woman, phenomenally. Phenomenal woman, that's me.
Now, Angela France is going to read some poems around prison, which are are they written by you? I wasn't quite clear. No.
I'll explain.
Okay.
Well, my day job, I work for a charity, and I've been working with women prisoners for quite a long time. I did a writing group for women, very young, very vulnerable women, and some of them had never written before. Most of them came from terrible backgrounds. One of the things I did was I took a video clip of Maya Angelou reading Still I Rise, and it really spoke to them. They really felt that she knew where they'd come from. And I'm really pleased. I'm going to read three short poems of these women's response to that video. And I'm delighted to bring these women's voices here because they are women who are silenced. And to show how Maya Angelou still inspires and uplifts women in the darkest of places. The first one is by Danny Hartley. Still I Walk Those Miles. They call me a criminal. I've been told I'm an animal. Still I walk those miles. They say I'm selfish. I've had no love. But still I walk those miles. They say I will always walk alone. But you're born alone and die alone. I still walk those miles. I will stride till my feet are sore and blistered. Still I live. I don't care about what people say about me, because I don't judge them and they shouldn't me. Still I live. You have to see in my eyes before you tell those lies. I will stand tall, head high, with a huge smile. Still I live and still I walk those miles. The second one is by Lisa Stewart, and this is a very young woman who had never written before. Love, again. You can lie about me, call me names. You even chose to beat me and put my name in shame. We lost our little girl, even our home, but I tell you, you're not going to break me. I will find love again. Does it hurt you when I say I'll be happy again and have a family, or even when I laugh or smile? You've just made me stronger to love again. Even though I wish you would change, but you cause far too much pain, I will be in love again. And the last one is by Abby Hanford. Excuse me. Human. I am a human being. Despite my life of crime, you wrote me off, threw away the key, but soon you'll see me shine. I might be bent and broken, I may have lost my pride. I was so far gone, but I pulled it back. I'm determined you'll see me shine. I hurt you time and time again, caused you misery, heartache, pain. I lost my trust, I'll get it back as soon as you see me shine. I'm trying to better myself. I've turned my back on drugs. I'm looking good and feeling fine. One day soon, you'll see me shine.
And now Jules Sparks is going to read Refusal and the Lesson.
you. I had absolutely no idea she was 6'3". I think I've fallen in love with her all over again. That's just amazing. And I also can't believe that there was a time when it was believed that the English audience wouldn't feel any connection to her poetry, because we were all asked to choose some poems that spoke to us, and we came along with our lists. And there was a little bit of chatting about, oh, well, I'll do this one. But we all chose the ones that felt really strongly about, and it just came very, very naturally. So it's spoken to all of us, her work, all very individual people. I've chosen these two because they're fierce, they're defiant, but they also have a real sense of vulnerability and sensuality too. So this is Refusal. Beloved, in what other lives or hands have I known your lips? Sorry, we'll start that again. Refusal. Beloved, in what other lives or lands have I known your lips, your hands, your laughter brave, irreverent, those sweet excesses that I do adore? What surety is there that we will meet again on other worlds, some future time undated? I defy my body's haste. Without the promise of one more sweet encounter, I will not deign to die. The lesson. I keep on dying again. Veins collapse, opening like the small fists of sleeping children. Memory of old tombs, rotting flesh, and worms do not convince me against the challenge. The years and cold defeat have lived deep in lines along my face. They dull my eyes, yet I keep on dying because I love to live. Thank you.
Maya became a bestseller in England, in Britain, and she was grand. She could be grand, and she could be demanding, but she was the soul of generosity. We had lots of partying. People sort of handed over their flats. She cooked huge meals for us. I mean, we had a very communal relationship with her. All the Viragans came along, and then all her friends, and she cooked these magnificent meals, and we danced, and she roared with laughter. She was amazing about, she gave herself to friendships and indeed to love. I mean, her marriages may not have lasted, but she knew it was important to risk everything for love. She said, love liberates. As for relationships, she said, I'd learnt that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. She invited me to her place in North Carolina, where she lived in a large house. I was explaining it to you earlier. A very extraordinary house, very big rooms. It was a modernish house where you kept going from room to room, and the only way you knew you were in the next one is that the carpet changed. It was, and the other person staying at the house was Odetta. I don't know if anyone is as old as me and remembers Odetta, who sang with Bob Dylan, and wonderful black singer. And we went to her church, her local church. She once said to me, all black people belong to a church. It's what protects you when there's trouble. So we went to this event at her local church, which was packed to the rooftops, and I was one of five white people in this huge room of entirely black people. And the gospel choir sang, and Maya performed, and anyone who's seen her perform, there's no one like her for performing, singing and speaking ever more magnificently, and tears were rolling down most people's cheeks, including mine. So that was a very extraordinary experience. Right, well, now I want to ask Joe Bell to read Harlem Hopscotch and Caged Bird. Not Caged Bird. Sorry.
I'm conscious that this is a kind of reversal of that room entirely filled with black people. I am aware of the Caucasian-ness of the Ledbury Collective. And I chose Harlem Hopscotch because so much of what Maya Angelou wrote was about race and poverty and about refusing to be pigeonholed by refusing to sit in the pigeonhole that other people give you. Speaking up, speaking out, refusing to assume the identity of the victim. And it's about uncompromising strength and activism, which can be accompanied by grace and by laughter. And it seems to me that Virago Press has been very much about the same sort of values. Harlem Hopscotch. 1 foot down, then hop! It's hot. Good things for the one that's got. Another jump. Now to the left. Everybody for his cell. In the air. Now, both feet down. Since you're black, don't stick around. Food is gone. The rent is due. Curse and cry. And then jump too. All the people out of work. Hold for three, then twist and jerk. Cross the line, they count you out. That's what hopping's all about. Both feet flat. The game is done. They think I lost. I think I won.
I'm now going to ask Chloe Garner, our wonderful director of this festival, to read from I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Is that what you're going to read from? Yeah.
So, an extract from I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. When I was 3 and Bailey 4, we arrived in the musty little town wearing tags on our wrists which instructed to whom it may concern that we were Marguerite and Bailey Johnson Jr. from Long Beach, California, en route to Stamps, Arkansas, care of Mrs. Annie Henderson. Bailey was the greatest person in my world, my only brother. When he was less than 3, he was supposed to have said, "This is my sister, I have to teach her to walk." He refused to call me Marguerite, but addressed me as Maya sister. And in later, more articulate years, after the need for brevity had shortened the appellation to My, it was elaborated into Maya. Our parents had decided to put an end to their calamitous marriage, and father shipped us home to his mother. A porter was charged with our welfare, and our tickets were pinned to my brother's inside coat pocket. I don't remember much of the trip, but after we reached the segregated southern part of the journey, Negro passengers, who always travelled with loaded lunchboxes, felt sorry for the poor little motherless darlings and plied us with cold fried chicken and potato salad. Years later, I discovered that the United States had been crossed thousands of times by frightened black children, travelling alone to their newly affluent parents in northern cities or back to grandmothers in southern towns. We lived with our grandmother and uncle until I was 13 and left Arkansas for good.
She could be stern. She used to say, "Stand up straight and realize who you are, that you tower over your circumstances. You're a child of God. Stand up straight." She she got to know all our families, and I had a teenage daughter when we started publishing her, and who adored her, actually. But she was pretty stern with her. If Kate didn't stand up when she came into the room, that was not on. And my later on, because this went on for years, we published her over so many years, my granddaughter, we on one of the many celebratory occasions, there was a huge dinner for her at the Dorchester or somewhere like that, with tablefuls of people and lots of laughter and lots of reading of poetry. And I took my little three-year-old granddaughter amongst other people who'd lived, grown up in Cheshunt in outside London, and I think had never seen a black person. And she followed her everywhere. She absolutely just became a sort of focus of her attention. She wrote something called Letter to My Daughter. She didn't have a daughter. This is what she says. My life has been long, and believing that life loves the liver of it, I have dared to try many things, sometimes trembling, but daring. I gave birth to one child, a son, but I have thousands of daughters. You are black and white, Jewish and Muslim, Asian, Spanish-speaking, Native American, and Aleut. You are fat and thin and pretty and plain, gay and straight, educated and unlettered, and I'm speaking to you all. Here is my offering to you. You may not control all the events that happen to you, but you can decide not to be reduced by them. Try to be a rainbow in someone's cloud. Do not complain. Make every effort to change things you do not like. If you cannot make a change, change the way you've been thinking. You might find a new solution. Never whine. Whining lets a brute know that a victim is in the neighborhood. Be certain that you do not die without having done something wonderful for humanity. So we're going to end. Actually, we might have a bit of extra time at the end, but let's see how it goes, and maybe people would like to read more poems. We didn't get the timing quite right. We're going to end with a poem read by Juliet Stevenson, and then there's going to be a film clip. So Juliet's going to read Prelude to a Party.
I share it with Jo. I would have said it if I'd been as brave as she was. An apology for the colour of my skin. I do feel very conscious that it's a kind of bit weird to have an evening reading Maya Angelou all white. Never mind. We had this long conversation, debate about it earlier today, and I was swayed by Ursula saying that Maya herself would want her poems to be completely universal and be read by a wide range of people, so it wasn't as... wouldn't have been offensive to her, so anyway, here we all are. And I will read Prelude to a Parting, and I also found another, if we've got a bit of time, there's also another rather lovely one I found.
We have got time, we've got time.
So here's Prelude to a Parting, which is a rather surprising one, I thought, to me anyway, from her. Prelude to a Parting. Beside you, prone, my naked skin finds fault in touching. Yet it is you who draws away. The tacit fact is, the awful fear of losing is not enough to cause a fleeing love to stay. They ask why. A certain person wondered why a big, strong girl like me wouldn't keep a job which paid a normal salary. I took my time to lead her and to read her every page. Even minimal people can't survive on minimal wage. A certain person wondered why I wait all week for you. I didn't have the words to describe just what you do. I said you had the motion of the ocean in your walk. And when you solve my riddles, you don't even have to talk.
Thank you. because we have got a little bit of time. I was curious to know why you've come and what you feel about Maya and what effect she's had on you. And I just wondered if some of you in the audience would talk about that. Yeah. And she was 6'3", wasn't she? Yeah. Right. Anyone else? Yeah. Can you speak? Yeah, I'm afraid you have to speak up. I don't think we've got a mic. Yeah, amazing. Anyone else? Yeah. Good reason. So shall we show some film now?
Everyone in the world has gone to bed one night or another with fear or pain or loss or disappointment. And yet each of us has awakened, arisen, somehow made our ablution, seen other human beings, and said, "Morning, how are you? Fine, thanks, and you?" It's amazing. Wherever that abides in the human being, there is the nobleness of the human spirit, despite it all, black and white. Asian, Spanish, Native American, pretty, plain, thin, fat, vowed or celibate, we rise. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may trod me in the very dirt, but still like dust, I'll rise. Does my sassiness upset you? Why are you beset with gloom? Just because I walk as if I have oil wells pumping in my living room. Just like suns and like moons with the certainty of tides. Just like hope springing high, still I rise. Did you want to see me broken? Bowed head and lowered eyes, shoulders falling down like teardrops, weakened by my soulful cries. Does my sassiness upset you? Don't take it so hard just because I laugh. As if I have gold mines digging in my own backyard. You can shoot me with your words. You can cut me with your lies. You can kill me with your hatefulness. But just like life, I'll rise. Does my sexiness offend you? Oh, does it come as a surprise that I dance? As if I have diamonds at the meeting of my thighs. Out of the huts of history's shame, I rise. Up from a past rooted in pain, I rise. A black ocean leaping and wide. Welling and swelling, I bear in the tide. Leaving behind nights of terror and fear, I rise. Into a daybreak miraculously clear, I rise. Bringing the gifts that my ancestors gave. I am the hope and the dream of the slave. And so, naturally, there I go, rising.
Well, I guess there's nothing more to say after that. So thank you very much for coming. It's so good.